We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrix. Joining me today is Justin Hune, the Uranium Insider. Thanks for joining me today, Justin.
Great to be back, Tom.
So there's been lots of news recently in the uranium space. So why don't we start there? How important is it in this space to have someone like Elon Musk, for example, talking about and endorsing uranium?
I think, the underlying supply and demand fundamentals for the sector are there regardless of who's talking about it at this point. But I think that it just goes to add to the legitimacy of nuclear power to hear more prominent voices be speaking in favor of it. It definitely helps the public opinion of nuclear energy. And that seems to be growing and improving by the day. So it certainly adds to the stack, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's necessary for the fundamental thesis as far as the investing goes and for the sector, but it certainly helps to have these voices come out in favor. Yeah,
absolutely. And of course, you know, we've seen some pretty big news stories come out this week. We saw Denison recently raised $75 million to buy 2.5 million pounds. And also UEC is establishing a physical uranium purchasing initiative and has entered into an agreement to purchase another 400,000 pounds. So how important are developments like these to the market as well?
I think that these are really, really important developments for a couple of reasons. One, nobody really predicted this. This is a sea change for non-producing uranium companies to be establishing physical uranium holdings. And it's also really interesting because Denison Mines is a manager of the Uranium Participation Corp, which is a physical uranium fund. Their stated purpose is to raise, to issue shares, to raise cash when they're trading at a premium to NAV, which they are, and they have been for about a month now. They're about 20 something to low 20% premium to NAV today. And they've yet to kind of pull the trigger on that. And the market's kind of waiting for that to happen. Yet kind of out of left field comes Denison with this $75 million bought deal to buy 2.5 million pounds at $30 a pound, which is at the point yesterday when the news came out, spot was trading in the low 27s. So for them to come out and say, all right, not only are we a non-producing uranium company, we're about to step into the market and buy some physical, but we're going to do it at a premium to the current spot price. And the market had an immediate reaction. The spot price has already jumped up into the high 29 since yesterday. So that's up, 8%, 9% since yesterday. That's a really strong move. And I think that's the beginning of a move. So yeah, it's a big development for sure. It's a big development. It's because it really raises the question of, well, if these guys can do it, who else can do it? Anybody can do it, you know. And the cost of capital is so low, and it's flowing with such abundance into the space right now that it would be, assuming there's enough liquidity in the spot market, given. It would be easy enough for other players to raise money here and do the same thing. So it seems to have lit a fire in the spot market, at least for now. And I think it could start this trend, because there's other players, the producing companies like Cameco, that they need to buy. Well, they stated a need to purchase 8 to 10 million pounds in 2021 from the spot market prior to any Cigar Lake closure impacts. So we're looking at, what are we now? We're 4 months of Cigar being closed. It's likely to go at least another two, if not more. So that's an additional, 4.5 million pounds. So now we're looking at 12.5 to 14.5 million pounds that Cameco will need to buy this year. And I don't believe they've bought much, if any. So we know that the producers are coming in addition to whoever else might be there. And that's not even to question whether or not the utilities will take any part in any of this and whether or not, because Kazatomprom will be buying, you know, they actually released their 2020 financials and did a conference call very early this morning. They're still guiding for the same guidance that they put out last year for this year, which is on the low end of their subsoil use agreements, which is essentially their production contracts, and they can flex up and down 20% based on their previously stated production goals. So they're planning to produce at the low end of that, the 20% below those subsoil use contracts, which is about 60 million pounds, a little bit less than that, 58, high 50s. But they did say that it's possible they might come into the spot market to top up their inventories, and that they still don't know the full extent of the impacts from last year's closures. So yeah, interesting market for sure.
Absolutely. And you've been describing the supply equation as fragile at the moment. So can you give us a sense of the real changes in this equation since the last time we spoke? Of course, there's been the recent announcement of the Cominiac mine coming offline at the end of March because of the depletion of its resource. So does this change the supply side of the industry a lot?
It does. It changes it a bit to the extent that, well, yes, it definitely changes it. The mines that have come offline, which have permanently closed since we last spoke, which is the Ranger mine in Australia and the Cominiac mine in Niger. And Cominiac is majority owned by Orano. And Orano has historically been a pretty significant spot market seller. So that's some supply that's going to them. You know, the last 10 years or so, that mine has averaged about 3.5 million pounds a year. And that's gone at the end of this month. They'll be closing the end of March. The Ranger mine was similar production levels. I believe it might have even been a bit more for the past 10 years. These are mines that have been running for decades. So for those two closures to happen now, while the market is relatively thin and we're seeing all this other action that I just mentioned, it's a pretty big deal. It's not in the total picture, it's not a huge amount of pounds, but it continues to chip away at the diversity of sources into the market, which continues to drop. So now that fragile supply, really the bulk of the supply that's coming into the market right now is coming from Kazakhstan. They're still by far the largest producer. And they have a number of JVs there with Cameco, with Uranium One, with Orano, with the Chinese. They have offtake agreements with China and with India. And Cameco is producing 0 pounds out of Canada right now. There's essentially nothing coming out of the States. There's some production coming out of Namibia from China at the Husab mine. And there's a bit coming out of Australia at BHP's Olympic Dam, about 8 million pounds a year, which does come into the spot market. So, but still you have an essential industry with about 11% of global energy production, 20% of the energy of the grid in the United States. And you have almost all of it being produced from one country. It's really quite astonishing. Oh, there's a little bit coming from Uzbekistan as well. And they seem to be a growing producer, but it's just not enough. I mean, we need two more Kazatomproms by the end of the decade. So it's right now, supply is tight. It's fragile. We have mines offline. We need higher prices before they come online. And then if you look out past 2025, the situation gets a bit scary when it comes to the care and maintenance mines have to come online. And by 2030, pretty much everything that's proposed right now is going to have to be in production. That's going to take billions and billions of dollars of capital and uranium prices in the 65, 70 range at least. So it's quite the setup.
Mm-hmm. So of course we're speaking on March the 16th in the afternoon here. And other than today, we've recently seen the spot price keep coming down gradually, but we have yet to see the uranium equities do the same. They've in fact been rallying a little bit. So is this a case of smart investors trying to get ahead of the market and position themselves before a big wave of money comes into the space?
Yeah, we believe so. I mean, I think the wave of big money coming into the space has already started to happen. It's still a relatively small sector. I mean, even after the move in equities today, which has been pretty strong, we're still in the low 20s billions total market capitalization for the sector. The previous peak uranium bull market was about 150 billion. So there's a long ways to go as far as the equity markets go when it comes to total valuation for the sector, assuming we see the price movement that we're expecting. So the spot price ticked up last year when Cameco announced the closure of Cigar Lake. That was March 23rd last year, because Kazatomprom followed suit a couple of weeks later. But what we saw with the spot price movement there, there was a bit of trading happening, but it mostly was Cameco buying and for delivery at Cameco at their Port Hope conversion facility. And so what we really saw was the underlying overall spot price moved up a little bit, but the delivery location premium really expanded. So we had more than a 10% delivery premium at Cameco. So when it rose up to 34, it was pushing $35, I believe. The spot price at the other locations was still in the low 30s. So when the spot price started to dwindle, we kind of knew that it was happening on really low volume. It wasn't like there was a lot of volume coming in of end user purchasing, whether that be Cameco, whether that be utilities. It's mainly just traders kind of trading the same pounds back and forth, trying to kind of play the volatility, the slowly dropping price. If we see large volumes come into the spot market and the price is falling, that would be concerning. That isn't what has happened. And judging by the equities movements starting in December, I would say that that's definitely a strong sign of smart money coming into the space. It's a recognition by generalist funds, ESG funds, institutions that this is a growth sector. It's a sector that's been demolished over the past decade until about last year. And it's a sector that holds huge, huge upside potential with the quote unquote green energy revolution, with decarbonizing the electrical grids around the world. More and more countries are coming online with that rhetoric and those plans. China is expanding massively. It's a huge growth story. So it's interesting because we've had a lot of speculation by doubtful retail in the past couple of months going, what the heck's going on here? This is a speculative frenzy. It's going to sell off. It's going to crash back down, because that's what has happened with every rally in uranium in the past 4 years. And this is fundamentally different, in my opinion. We've had the thesis. The thesis is starting to play out. It's a very small universe of equities. And we've had the objective from the beginning to find the equities that will have their own unique catalyst, an individual company catalyst. So even if the market itself underlying doesn't move yet, the companies will. And so that's what we've done with the newsletter anyways, is try to provide alpha to the general market. And it's done pretty well so far. But yeah, it's real money's come into the space in the past few months. I mean, the AUM for URNM ETF that launched early part of last year, just a few million dollar IPO, is now over 100, I think it's 175 million. We've seen hundreds of millions of dollars come into the sector just in the past few weeks. It's a really good sign. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely exciting times to see this kind of uptick. And exactly, you know, the same thing we can kind of parallel towards the spot price. You recently called the bottom for the spot price. So what factors went into you making that call?
I had been watching it pretty closely as far as volumes, and I knew that the price action was on very small volumes being traded. I certainly did not see that Denison would be raising money to buy physical. So that's been a nice catalyst for the movement upwards. But I have known all along that Cameco has to come into the market. So it's just a matter of time. So I just kind of saw the trend in price slow and then stop for a couple of days. And it just seemed like it was the call. So far it's been a good one. And I think, yeah, just knowing that buying is incoming and the price action that caused it to drop a few dollars was on such low volumes, it was insignificant. And clearly the equities market, you know, mostly knew that as well, at least the smart money did, which is why we've seen, 100, 150% returns on some of these things since December. It's wild. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Justin, you don't think that the spot price in this cycle will exceed the last all-time high. So why is this not as big of an issue as some might think?
I think it's because of the movement of the capital and the fact that we have a greater recognition of the importance of this sector that's growing. And it is a growth sector. We're looking at, 1 to 3% growth for the next two decades. And the fact that we have, it's a different world than it was in 2006, 2007. We have instant global communication. We have computers in our pockets. We have massive speculative frenzies and money coming into, the next big thing all the time from, Robinhood traders and things like that. It's just a different world when it comes to the capital markets than it was back then. And I believe honestly that we're going to breach that previous market cap of 150 billion. We're going to breach that by the time we hit $55 a pound uranium. That said, it's entirely possible that we go higher than the previous peak. I'm just not counting on it. And the previous move from $100 to $134 spot, it overshot the long-term prices, which is what the utilities were playing. That was kind of a sign that the top was incoming when the spot price jumped above term price very steeply. And it was on low volumes, and it was traders and it was hedge funds that were buying and selling. And so could that happen again? Absolutely. In fact, I think we will see an overshoot. We know the price is going into the mid 60s, just because that's where it has to go in order to bring on production to feed the sector, essentially, you know, beyond 2025, which is tomorrow in nuclear terms. But the overshoot will happen. How high it goes, nobody really knows, and it doesn't really matter. I just think this market is so much stronger fundamentally. And we're going to see great valuations at much lower prices. So if it goes to that level, fantastic. It's not something I'm betting on, but you know, anything above that $65 is just out of the hands, you know, mostly out of the hands of utilities, really. I mean, I think the capital markets are really what's going to determine where this market goes, which is interesting because we've been waiting for years for the fundamentals of the sector and the nuclear fuel market to move the capital market. And now that's flipped. And I think that is flipped for good, at least for this cycle. So it's really going to be up to the capital markets. And of course, the utilities, you know, they're going to need to restock at some point soon. And I think if they sit on their hands another 6 to 12 months, and we could see a really substantial price spike scenario, probably 2022, 2024.
So why is the SWU price trend that has been climbing for the last two and a half years a positive indication for spot as well?
Because a positive indication for the sector, I don't know if it's necessarily a positive indication for the spot market, but the spot market primarily deals with U308. And so the SWU price, the separative work unit price, is the cost of enrichment. So when we see the SWU price rising, that basically means that the demand for enrichment is growing. And that's a good sign. Because when the SWU price was at the bottom, which was 2.5 years ago, right? That was the summer of 2018, I believe, if I recall correctly. I think so. It was 2019. I'm forgetting. It was August. It was 2018 or 2019. But when that bottomed, there was just so much excess enrichment capacity that there was a lot of secondary supply coming into the market through underfeeding and through tails re-enrichment. So as SWU rises, that means that some of that excess capacity is continuing to be utilized by end user purchasing new contracts, new demand for enrichment. So it's a double whammy. It's a positive sign that that demand is coming back, and that secondary supply that had come into the market pretty heavily over the past decade is also slowing down. So, and it's also, you know, that's the highest point besides fuel fabrication in the fuel cycle is enriching uranium. And so sometimes what utilities will do to avoid purchasing in the spot market, purchasing U308 and pushing that price up, they'll go further up the fuel cycle and buy UF6 and buy EUP. And so to see that demand strong, it's sort of just a matter of time before that demand is to the point where it makes sense to go back into the beginning of the fuel cycle and re-up on U308 and buy the contracts for conversion and enrichment at the same time. So it's definitely a positive sign. And the people that have really been watching, that have really called the market well, like the Bill Sheriffs from Encore Energy of the world, they've been watching SWU the whole time. And they didn't expect a market turnaround until they saw SWU turn around. And that's when he and some other players in the market started to get excited. It's like, okay, SWU bottomed. It's now been going up for 6 months consistently. And now it's going up for, you know, more than 2 years consistently. It continues to climb. It was up another $2 last month. It's a great sign, yeah, for the fuel cycle and the sector at large. Yeah.
Excellent. So Justin, given the diversity of new technologies on the horizon for SMRs, are there any of the new designs that use fuels that aren't based on U308 and would take away any of the demand from what is forecasted?
Well, it's interesting because there isn't really a lot of demand forecasted for the new advanced nuclear, you know, SMRs, the small modular reactors. That demand is still in question because they're still kind of in prototype stage. So that any demand that comes from that is kind of a bonus at this point. I think that perhaps the upper scenario from the WNA fuel report in 2019, I don't know for sure, but that could possibly be working in some projected demand from advanced nuclear, from SMRs. But yeah, I believe that there is some work on thorium reactors. I don't know to the extent how much that's infiltrated the SMR space. I think that there is some promise for that in the future. But to my knowledge, the most prominent companies that are in organizations that are working on SMRs are dealing with what's called HALEU. It's high assay, low enriched uranium. And it's uranium that, you know, for a typical nuclear reactor, you have uranium that's enriched to 3.5 to 5% U-235. And these are enriched up to 20%. So it looks like they're going for a higher enrichment level and minimal refuelings. So a single fueling of one of these SMRs can last, you know, 15, 20 years potentially. So there's pretty awesome technology. We don't really know what the demand is going to be. We can kind of expect that there will be some demand coming, you know, out to the end of the decade and beyond from this technology. But I don't think that there's any potential for alternative fuel technologies to hurt any projected demand. Yeah.
So, Justin, you were mentioning earlier that there's producers like Cameco and Kazatomprom that need to come into the market and buy uranium. This might be confusing to some that don't follow the space closely. So can you explain why this is, please?
Sure. Cameco, for example, has long-term contracts on their books. So they have commitments to deliver uranium to nuclear utilities. And they are buying in the market because they've shut down their mines because of the low price environment. So they closed McArthur River, which is the largest uranium mine in the world. That's in Saskatchewan, Canada. They closed that in July of 2018 and due to low prices. And so that was, you know, they originally did that in order to not only do their own purchasing. It's a double whammy again, because it's not only is it pounds not coming into the market, but they're taking pounds out of the market by purchasing. And it was kind of to send a signal to the market, to utilities, that it's like, okay, well, if utilities aren't going to sign more long-term contracts at prices that support our operation, we're just going to shut it down and buy some of this highly liquid mobile inventory that existed at the time, which we believe has been mostly worked through in these past 3 years since that happened. And then Cigar Lake is closed down right now due to COVID precautions. They shut it in December. You know, there's whispers about it coming back, but nothing official. We think that they'll give some guidance on its restart in their conference call for the first quarter, which should happen in April. But we're not really sure when that's coming online. So they have, McArthur River is an 18 million pound a year uranium mine, same with Cigar Lake. And Cameco, their offtake from McArthur is in a majority. I don't remember exactly offhand. It's more than half, and they've got, I believe it's 50% of Cigar. So it's a lot of pounds that they are not producing, but they still need to fulfill these contracts that they have commitments to. So they have to purchase in order to fulfill those commitments. It's not really a long-term solution, I don't believe, but it's something that they needed to do in order to kind of fix the market and bring the market back to a price that supports their operation and generally supports more production in the world besides Kazatomprom, which doesn't produce enough to sustain the global nuclear energy needs. Yeah, not even close. Yeah.
So looking forward right now, Justin, do you have a sense for how friendly the Biden administration is to nuclear energy?
It appears to be friendly. Honestly, the Biden administration has been kind of out to lunch, really. I haven't really seen much. I don't even know what's going on. It feels like we don't have a president right now. It's really strange. I don't know how it looks to the rest of the world, but it's odd here. But from what we've seen so far, they seem to be supportive. It seems in general that the political left and the environmental left is increasingly embracing nuclear as clean energy and an essential part of that mix. Of course, that's something we've known forever, you know, since we've been looking at the sector anyways, and anybody that really starts to crunch the numbers can recognize, okay, this is not producing any carbon emissions and it's baseload power. And the nuclear waste issue is greatly, greatly overstated because it's so highly regulated and so minimal relative to what it's producing. And, you know, renewables have their place, but we can't just go all out renewables without grid scale storage of energy because they don't produce all the time. So it's, you know, it's a clear and obvious choice. And it seems like the Biden administration is in support. We haven't heard otherwise. So it's looking positive. Yeah.
So Justin, turning to, investing in this space, what are some different strategies that you use in this space? Would you break up your portfolio between ETFs, producers, and developers?
Sure. So for our newsletter, we focus primarily on developers. We don't own any ETFs because we're sort of, creating our own portfolio that kind of acts as an ETF in a way. And you can weight the underlying stocks accordingly. ETFs, I really like the URNM ETF for anyone that likes ETFs as an easy way to invest in the space and gain exposure. They're 100% allocated and they have higher allocations to some of the juniors, which is nice. And I like the way they're managed and the people running the company. So that's great. But we primarily focus on companies that are developing assets and are still writing their stories are the stocks that we really like. The companies that are going to have their own individual company catalyst come out during the bull market are really, I think, what move resource stocks more than a company that already has an asset and they're just sitting on it and waiting. And I mean, not to criticize that because they've done the work prior to produce that asset and develop or at least explore and prove it out. So that's worth something for sure. But the exciting stocks to me are the ones that start out quiet, not a lot of people know about, and that you have a trust in their management, you have a trust in their process, you kind of have an idea of where they're going to go, where they're going to take the company. That's where we've positioned for the most part. We do own a couple of explorers that and companies that are accumulating assets, but usually those are companies that already have kind of the exploration risk off the table. So it's not, and we do like some exploration companies, but they're usually a little bit, too high risk for us to recommend in the newsletter. So we like companies that have already at least partially proven out an asset or have an alternative game plan to acquire assets. That's what we've done so far. And so far, so good. We're up about 285% since August of 2019. And we've done good to create alpha. And I really like that strategy. I like the companies that are still writing their story. I think that's the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. So as part of your, investing thesis, do you think about not investing where the institutions are and instead investing where they're going to?
I think to some extent, the institutions will end up everywhere, especially right now with less than 60 companies. Eventually, if we see what happened the last time with hundreds of companies, I think it's going to be very important to keep abreast of what those companies are and who is running them and how they're coming into fruition. We haven't seen that craziness yet, which is a good sign that we're really still at the start of this thing. Anytime if you can front run institutions and position yourself at a lower cost basis before big money comes in and provides liquidity to get out eventually, that's obviously an amazing strategy. Larger positions, larger investments are probably going to be going into the mid and large caps anyways. So that's one way that retail sometimes has an advantage in resource markets is being able to recognize smaller cap stocks that some of the institutions they physically cannot buy. That's a great strategy if you can get in.
So Justin, as a lot of our listeners are very familiar with gold and gold juniors, let's say, what is the outlook for M&A in this space at this time? And do we need higher prices to see more of this?
I think the outlook is good. I think that yes, higher prices will definitely kick it into gear more. We've already seen a bit. We start starting to see some companies acquire assets from other companies, from private companies. We've seen a few new companies come into the space in the past 12 months or so. But we'll definitely be seeing more M&A. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. And higher prices will justify that as well.
Mm-hmm. So what are some factors that would make a company something that you would not want to invest in, Justin?
Good question. I don't like companies that have, let's call it a sloppy share structure. So I prefer lower share counts without having done a reverse split in recent history. I prefer a lower percentage of outstanding warrants and options to the over to the outstand to the I prefer a lower percentage of options and warrants to the shares outstanding is there's less of an overhang and a tighter share structure, a lower float, a larger percentage of the shares outstanding owned by institutions and insiders is something that we always look for. So the fewer shares as a percentage of the whole that are actually floating in the market means that when money comes into the stock, that the stock moves more violently. So we look at share structure a lot. I prefer, you know, now we're getting into the bull market and it's less important now, but in positioning the past couple of years, it's been really important to look at things like G&A expenses, cash burn, salaries. When those were really bloated in a bear market, that's really a big turnoff for me. Once we start into a quote unquote raging bull market, there's just going to be so much money flying around that share count and frequency and style of dilution, equity raises, it becomes less important because it just becomes such a frenzy. But you know, I always like to look at G&A expenses. I like to look at share structure. I like to look at management. Insider ownership is big. Those are the things we look at. You know, honestly, we look at those things more so than we do the asset. But we also, one bottom line for us is we don't own any companies that have primary assets in jurisdictions that are historically not supportive of uranium mining. At least like to know that whatever they're working on has some chance of becoming something. So that's pretty important. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Justin, just as we wrap up here, can you just give us your thoughts on why energy stocks are among some of the best performing assets in an inflationary time?
Sure. Yeah. Well, obviously I think that, you know, inflation as such, you'll see the price of commodities, the underlying commodities rise, and that, you know, that forces the equities that are associated with those underlying commodities to catch a bid. And then historically, you know, I think that this rotation out of growth and into value in conjunction with a inflationary environment really means that we'll see a strong commodities market. And I personally believe uranium is probably going to be one of, if not the most, the better performing pieces of that commodities bull. But I think that everything, you know, in the commodity space for the most part, it's going to run together. It should be a good multi-year bull run, in my opinion.
Excellent. Do you have any thoughts as we wrap up here, Justin, that you'd like to add?
Let's see. I think, you know, the thing that just keeps coming up, especially on Twitter, is there's a number of people that are just really expecting a sell-off to happen. You know, that this is a speculative frenzy. And I just want to say, you know, with as much conviction as I convey as possible, that this market has fundamentally changed since December. It's a different market now. This is not retail just chasing the 25 cent uptick and downtick of the spot market. Something is different here. Real money has come into the space, and I don't believe that it's based on pure speculation. It appears to be smart money, and I think that it's only a matter of time before funds that are positioning in equities over the last 4 months will potentially in conjunction work to actually purchase physical and squeeze the market as they did in the previous bull market. It's coming. Is it coming tomorrow? I don't think so. I think that they're still positioning in the equities, but I feel extremely strongly about that. And that's, you know, that's how we're positioning. That's what we're recommending in our newsletter. So I think that it's a different market. Is this the first inning? No. Is it the fifth inning? No. We're probably in the second inning of this thing. So it's we're still very early, and it should be a good few years. Yeah.
Excellent. Tell our listeners what they can expect from your newsletter there.
We put out a really in-depth newsletter once a month at the beginning of each month with a very thorough macro section in addition to any developments for the individual companies that we follow. They receive our stock picks. And they receive individual bulletins that will go out as needed throughout the month based on either important macro news or company developments that are more urgent that need to be included in the following month's newsletter. But yeah, we're hyper-focused on uranium. So, I mean, it's literally all we do is uranium every day, day and night. And so it's a complicated sector. And I think that that's really where we give the most value, is keeping people apprised of what's going on and trying to put into layman's terms what's happening in the fuel cycle, what's happening in the nuclear energy market and in the equities market. So yeah.
Excellent.
We produce alpha. That's what we're trying to do, is beat the market, just like every other investor. And we're doing pretty good at that so far.
Excellent. And of course, we can find that at uraniuminsider.com and also at Uranium Insider on Twitter. Thanks very much for your time today, Justin.
My pleasure, Tom. Yeah, anytime. Good to see you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.